Hello everybody, this is Chandradasa at the Buddhist Centre online, thebuddhistcentre.com, and our ongoing new series of Buddhist Voices continues today with the very lovely Ami Tashuri, who has come all the way to America to have this conversation, which is great. Welcome, Ami Tashuri.
Thank you, Chandradasa.
Hey, so here you are, you're in the United States. What are you up to over the festive period?
Yes, well, I'm here, I visited some family in Canada. And I'm on my way down to Florida to spend time where my mum and dad are 50 years married. So they're treating us to come over to Florida to be with them for Christmas.
What anniversary is 50 years?
Golden.
Their golden wedding anniversary. That's so nice.
Yeah.
So you're here and you're travelling around. And it's been really nice to spend a couple of days with you in our little town of Portsmouth.
Definitely, yeah.
See you engage with people. Ami Tashuri is one of the best people I've ever met at engaging with people. The waitress, the person bringing your reading last night we were at together, it was very interesting watching you meet people and engage, which is quite significant, isn't it? Because that is your line of work.
You are,
I suppose, in our ongoing formation, as it were, as a Buddhist chaplain. Would that be a way of putting it?
Ongoing formation as a Buddhist chaplain, yeah, definitely ongoing.
Yeah, ongoing. So do you want to say a bit about chaplaincy generally and the context you work in? Maybe for some people listening, they didn't even know you had Buddhist chaplains. They might think of chaplains as a Church of England vicar with a dog collar, and you're definitely not wearing a dog collar.
Well, it's true. Yeah, the word chaplaincy itself is not a Buddhist word. It's a Christian word. And for me, the equivalent would be Kalyanamitrata.
What does that mean?
Spiritual friendship. So when I attend to, when I go into a context where I'm practicing as a chaplain, I sense my intention is to be there as a spiritual friend to people. So to say a little bit about it, I've completed the first year of a training course with the Buddhist Healthcare Chaplaincy Support Group, placed between London at the Buddhist Society and Birmingham at the, I think it's a pagoda in a Burmese temple there in Birmingham. And it's been my training. I finished my first year and I've received an initial endorsement, which enables me to work within public institutions like I'm doing now, the NHS.
And the NHS is the National Health Service in the United Kingdom.
Correct.
State-run healthcare.
Yes.
Very effective.
Yeah, sometimes can be.
Good. So this whole direction in your life, why did you decide to take up Buddhist chaplaincy? What was the impetus for that?
Now we're asking the questions. Yeah. I've just turned 44, and a lot of my life since I was 21, I've been a hospital patient a lot during that time. I've had chronic renal failure and I had a brain hemorrhage, and I've got an ongoing kidney condition and brain condition. So I've received quite a lot of care, support, treatment, trauma. And also I've felt myself to be able to find a wellness in myself whilst I'm in hospital, what it's like to be a patient in relationship to caregivers. And most recently, in the last couple of years, I had a kidney transplant. I had my kidneys out and I had a kidney transplant and was on dialysis for a while. So I was in quite a lot of contact with nurses and other fellow patients. And as a Buddhist, I could sense the impact that I had in the relationships that I formed during that quite crucial time of my life.
It's a very interesting combination, isn't it? When you've got the kind of experience you've got, which makes a very good basis for empathy, obviously. And then you've got this lovely intentionality about being a friend to people. It's a great combination. Yeah. That's what people need, isn't it, when they're suffering? It's like,
It really, even hearing you say that back to me moves me. That it's what I'm so grateful that such a context, a vocation, a job exists, such as chaplaincy. I do when I'm there, when I'm alive to my engagement with people in the world. It is like a calling. It is a vocation for me. I'm perfect for the job. The job is an ideal job for me.
Now, it's funny because I was thinking when we discussed doing this interview, I'd obviously heard of Buddhist chaplaincy before, and I'd heard about it both here in the US and in the UK, but only in the context of prison visiting. I think there's an organisation called Angulimala, isn't there, that does prison chaplaincy. But hospital chaplaincy, it had never even occurred to me, but it's the most obvious thing.
Yeah.
It's very interesting that, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Prior to finding this particular course, I had been exploring doing an MA in healthcare chaplaincy at Leeds University, but it was a few years and it cost quite a lot of money, which I didn't have, having been ill for a while. And I found this course, which has been running for 4 years, run by this Buddhist organisation, and it's explicitly Buddhist. So it's how it's helping how to translate the... There's a document called Developing a Healthcare Chaplain's Capabilities and Competencies, and it's developed for chaplaincies across all faiths. So the Buddhist Healthcare Chaplaincy Support Group, or otherwise known as the Kalyanamitra Network, can help see how they apply to the life of a Buddhist,
right.
How generosity, how compassion can live through the practices of putting these competencies into action.
But of course, you're not only working with Buddhists, are you? You're working with whoever's there. And we had a great conversation the other day when you first arrived about, well, in what sense are you a Buddhist chaplain, or in what sense are you just a person meeting another person, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So what is the... Does this Kalyanamitra Network?
Yeah.
What would you say is the specifically Buddhist bit, at least from your angle as somebody who's doing it? What's the specifically Buddhist bit for you? Why does it effectively, in a way, exemplify your practice as a Buddhist?
I'm letting that question land in me. It's got a life there. What makes it for me as a Buddhist a live practice, and working with other faiths? Immediately coming up was the Bodhisattva ideal.
Mm-hmm.
And really believing in the potential of every other human being.
Mm.
Yeah. And I've got a resonance just now when I really feel my way into that. That is why I do it. I believe that everybody, you know, people are with the most excruciating suffering. And to have somebody sit with them, to be with them.
Mm.
What more, you know, kindness, compassion, generosity, what are we given? I've been given a new kidney, I've been given life and limb. What can I give? You know, I've got that question, what can I give in this situation? And one of the biggest, most common answers for me is presence. Giving presence, being there.
It's interesting meeting you, because you are very presenced. I mean, if you could see the gestures, everybody, you can't, unfortunately, this is radio rather than TV, but you're very physically present. And even when you're describing being with people, and that sense of being embodied with them, it's definitely not an abstract idea, is it? No. Compassion, it's a sitting with somebody.
Yeah.
Remember, was it Pamavadra talks about Anukampa, shaking with.
Trembling.
You sit and you tremble with people. That's
I feel my heart responding to people as I approach them. I make connection with them. I sense my way into the, or it might be a spontaneous, immediate, I sense their invitation to me to come over to their bed, to be with them.
Mm.
And yeah, it's an amazing receptivity, I suppose. Mm. That's my practice too.
Yeah. Are there bits of the job that are challenging? I mean, do you meet people in a way who are suffering in such a way that they're resisting contact? Does everybody naturally want contact, or do you find people who isolate themselves emotionally? Or
it's a good question. I've not actually met anybody that's resisted my approach somehow. What came to mind there was in the multi-faith centre, like you say, I work with other faiths. I guess people ask me about the Dharma, about being a Buddhist, and I'm the only person that doesn't have a theistic religion in that staff room. So one day I went into the prayer room while I was there. Oh, we were all there at lunchtime. I thought, I'm going to go in to the 12:15 prayer, sat there while everybody prayed to God, and I just sat there with them. And when I came out, my boss had said, was that a bit weird, Amitishiri? And I said, weird? What do you say? Was it weird when we were all talking to God and you were just sitting there? And I said, no, I hadn't thought of it as weird. It was more like I was there and everybody there was connecting with what really matters to them. So no, it was perfect. It was great. And I went, all right, okay then. And afterwards, the other chaplains asked me questions about how can you not believe in God? I mean, who would have created this then if not God? What So there's the challenge. You asked me about what challenges me. In that situation, if it was another Buddhist or someone at a Buddhist centre asking me those questions, I might be able to tell them about my faith, which I can in some ways to other faith leaders. But I am imagining that it has challenged me, because to what extent do I actually say, well, there's delusion, there's, how can there be a God, you know? So how much can I reveal of myself and my heart's response to reality?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because somebody there is challenging your faith, as it were, or at least they're trying to understand what the basis is of your faith, I suppose. And obviously you don't necessarily want to do that back. It's like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so to not be protective or defensive, but to really express the truth of it. And you said there's someone's challenging or they're interested in, and the question's there, I'm not sure to what extent they are challenging or interested in. That's which right. Which it is, I don't know.
And so it's hard to tell, isn't it?
It's hard to tell. So I want to receive them and exemplify, rather than tell, I'd rather live it.
Well, just that thing, I suppose, of you saying to the person who says, is that weird?
Yeah.
And your response is, well, actually, I was just being with you. Yeah. I mean, that seems to, from everything you've said so far, and that seems to be the kind of heart of it, is just being with.
Yeah.
Sitting with.
Yeah. You know? And we've got the same intention to meet whatever arises with kindness. Partly. I mean, that's part of, I'm sure, the other chaplain's intention.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, other intentions would involve their idea of God. But definitely the way it manifests in many ways is turning up as being there.
So where are you at with your training, as it were, your kind of ongoing training in this? Where are you at with it?
Yeah, so the first year was the attending, the studying, the practicing, the taking notes and reflective practice. And the second year is actually to put it into practice, but I didn't personally want to wait until the second year because I was quite committed to doing it, so I decided to do the work while I was learning it. So I managed to be persistent enough for the Manchester Royal Infirmary to take me on as a placement, and now they want me to stay there and have said, let's get you a badge, let's get you trust inducted. And yes, so I've been doing that and I'm going to continue. I'm now officially a volunteer chaplain. I've got this endorsement, and I've also got my own person that I see as a Buddhist chaplain explicitly in a mental health unit as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so we do meditation, and I've got another year of training. It's not so, well, I don't know how it's laid out in the way the first year is very well laid out. It's very clear days that we attend either Birmingham or London. And there's a mixture of people from different traditions. Quite a lot of Triratna people actually came to the training that I was on, which was really encouraging.
And so you have these, I suppose, encounters with people, sometimes people suffering a good deal, sometimes people alone, maybe people with families too. What effect is it having on your kind of ongoing sense of your own Buddhist life? Like, to keep going, it's like you go to that threshold and you come back. You go to that threshold and you come back.
Yeah. It's deepening me, it's expanding me. I just met someone this morning and I told them that when I walk around the hospital with my case on and I walk out into under the sky, I feel that sense of I'm not even sure where the quote's from. Today my human birth is fruitful, my human life is justified. Today I'm a daughter of the Buddha. I am so, so grateful that I can contribute in the way that's opened up to me. Bigger, deeper. I don't always know what to do with what I witness, and how am I able to be okay with that, to hold a space for the not knowing what to do with the extremity of the situations that I see in the hospital. And I'm the witness. I mean, there's people going through stuff.
It's interesting because that quote's from the Bodhicharyavatara, which is the path of awakening, and I think it's quite significant, isn't it? Because often when people talk about Buddhism, enlightenment, awakening, insight, it is all a bit abstract. It's like I'll get to a state and then I'll do those things. But actually, it's the path of awakening, and that whole thing of carrying yourself as a daughter of the Buddha and going into these realms and meeting people. And you don't have to be all sorted out to do that. It's a that is the practice.
Yeah.
Kindness, mindfulness.
And a lot of faith. A lot of Shraddha.
So for somebody listening who hears a Buddhist talk about faith, what would you... Because that's quite important, because a lot of people may have only come across faith as theistic faith. How would you define Shraddha, faith, in the Buddhist context that supports you in the work?
I'm going to give an example that doesn't necessarily support me in the work in that context. Before, when we sat down, me and Chandradasa sat down here, and I had written a couple of things down. I said, there's some part of me thinks I will need to know that and remember that. And Chandradasa says, I'm pretty sure you know stuff. You know stuff already. And I know all, this conversation we're having. It's more alive if I stay present with you, which we're both doing.
This would be terrible if it was scripted, wouldn't it? Yeah. We'd be like, hi, I'm Ujjuri. How are you today?
Yeah. So being in touch, for me, in that moment, faith was possible there. Yeah, actually, you're right. I know stuff. And just sitting back into that and breathing into that, allowing that, brought in a whole load more openness to me being relaxed and okay about whatever arose in this conversation. And I guess that's the same thing, walking into a ward, not knowing which bed I'm going to, maybe walking over to the wrong one and still somebody being open for a chat. So faith in that sense is that I am resourced enough to meet whatever shows up.
So presumably this way of being with people that you're training in and moving deeper into, I'm imagining it must have quite an effect on just your normal interactions with people. Like it's not that you can turn on a shallow button other time. But, do you find yourself in a way really observing people and being with people in a different way now since you started this work?
It's funny. I can sit on a train and the conductor will come up and sit and tell me about stuff that I think, oh my goodness, does he know that I'm a chaplain? How come? Or, I'll be in situations that people will open up to me. And I'm honoured, actually. I'm honoured because I'm present with people's experience and...
Well, you're open and interested as well.
What's giving, what's receiving. They're sharing something really important with me, for them. And I'm able to hear that and it already catalyses something. So does it change my relationships? I hope so.
And so what are your hopes for chaplaincy now? You're kind of in the middle of moving into a formal role as a chaplain in these contexts. Where would you like it to go?
Well, I imagine that I'll not just see patients. Well, that's not the case that I've just seen patients. I received some training, and at the end of it, the trainers were asking me, what is it about being Buddhist? And I said, let's try it. Do you want a taste rather than me telling you? And we did a little meditation. And from that, they've taken it to their wards, and they're part of an education and training unit in the hospital. And they want me to sort of take it across to their wards so that the nurses who work in high trauma areas where there's a lot of young deaths, a lot of sudden deaths and a lot of staff absenteeism, as a result, they'd like to have some tools to work with that. They know I'm Buddhist. They know I'm the chaplain in the hospital. And my own boss, I said, Amitajuri, that's fantastic. We've been trying and we've not been able to get into that area of the education. If you can do it, you've got something that we don't have, we can't offer. And if it supports the staff, then go for it. Why don't you even, if you want to, split your time so that some of the time you're doing this and some of your time you're doing that? And what support do you need? So the future for me is having someone like a team, my boss there behind me to encourage, to support me taking initiative and get paid for it eventually.
Now, do they hire chaplains as a kind of paid thing, or is it always a voluntary?
No, the only chaplains that aren't paid are the rabbi and the Catholic priest and nun, who I think are paid by the Catholic Church.
They're supported by their communities. So
yeah, and the volunteers, of which I'm one, are not paid. But I'm guessing, I'm imagining, I'm hoping that the more that I'm there, the more that they want me to be there.
Sure.
I've had employment through that kind of route before, that I've become a volunteer and then I've become employed. So I hope that that's what happens.
So presumably hopefully when you get hired as a chaplain, you mentioned earlier the capabilities and competencies of a chaplain. So can you give people an idea of what's really involved in assessing somebody's capability and competencies when it comes to chaplaincy work?
Yeah, so there's seven And in my review that I had with my boss, I said I'd like to do the review with these as my headings and how I got on and how I see the team getting on. So the first one was spiritual assessment and intervention, assessing what a patient's, someone's spiritual needs are. And then there's religious assessment and intervention. And all chaplains across the board, across religions, are working with this. Then practicing ethically. Yeah. Communication skills. Team working. Can we work with the multi-faith team, the multidisciplinary teams? Do we know about team dynamics? Reflective practice and personal spiritual development. Are we all going on retreats? Are we attending services, whatever the context is? And reflective practice was the one that I didn't see so alive in my own context. And when I fed that back, my boss had really said, you know what, I think you're absolutely right. Is there anything that you can do to support us to create a context for reflective practice in this office, in this team? So he's given me that as a something to do, if I like, offer some context to support reflective practice. So that's exciting. Yeah, so that's the seven capabilities and competencies, and that's from an NHS document from the Southeast. I think I mentioned that.
Now, can I ask a wee question about that? I was just thinking there, because they all sound very good and they sound very general, but say something like ethics, which is a very complex area when you go into it, and you've got all these different faith traditions all agreeing that there has to be a competency around the area of working ethically. How do you figure that stuff out with other... I mean, is there an ongoing process of engagement and dialogue with other chaplains of different faiths? Are there sort of core reference points for that, or do they in a way expect you to bring your context with you and make it clear to them, whoever's assessing, I suppose, training?
Yeah, there are core reference points, yes. So that particular capability or competency is laid out in that document. And when people do chaplaincy training, they have to go through this process and agree. And if it's something that's not in agreement in that area of ethics, then it would come up in their training, and they may not necessarily be endorsed at the end of it as a person of good standing within their community. So yeah, there are key reference points for each of the capabilities.
Yeah. So in a way, that's quite a practice in itself, isn't it? Just taking on that sort of self-scrutiny of your own practice and being open to sharing that with other people and letting them come into relationship.
Yeah, how it looks, in relationship. And more my experience of it was, and I enjoy this, was in the staff room. Actually, sometimes after lunch, someone will bring up an area. And it would usually figure under one of those headings. Someone will talk about a situation they've been in, and they'll bring that. What are the ethics involved in that? I had a question, I had to take it back to the office. Someone disclosed something to me, she asked me for help, and I wasn't sure what to do. And I said, do you know what, I'm going to go down and I'm going to talk to my team. I came down, talked to my team, and they really met me, and one of the other chaplains came up to attend to the patient with me. And they said, we have to do that because something's been disclosed to you. And if we don't support you, Amitashuri, to find the correct way to manage it, then you're left with it.
That's
right. They really, as a team, came in together and appreciated what I'd done to address it. So we're different faiths, but we're one team.
That's great. So are there any specifically Buddhist criteria that you bring in on top of those competences and capabilities that you feel actually you need to embody or bring with you?
Yeah, so that as part of the Kalyana Mitra network, not just as a Tridatna Buddhist, but as a Buddhist or as a human being, and practicing chaplaincy, which I said in my language would translate to spiritual friendship. The Buddha explained seven qualities of a monk who's considered to be what he called worthy of association, or the seven qualities of a spiritual friend. And yeah. That's one basis for reflection. And for me, well, I'll maybe say a little bit about what they are. He gives what's difficult to give, and he does what's difficult to do. He patiently endures what's difficult to endure. Yeah, I've had an experience of that. People just sometimes want to talk and talk, and actually, you know, what extent am I staying with that person at the cost of not seeing another patient? But I'm be patient with that. He reveals his own secrets. He keeps one's secrets, so that's to do with confidentiality. He does not abandon one in misfortune, and he does not despise one because of one's loss. So seven qualities of a spiritual friend. Sometimes they might sound a little bit wordy, but each of the training sessions that we've done with the chaplaincy support group actually goes right into, they'll spend the whole day exploring what that means in each of our lives. You know, what does it mean not to abandon one despite of one's loss? You know, somebody has someone that dies and they disappear out, they're not in contact anymore. So it's not just in chaplaincy, it's in life. That person,
that's right,
needs connection.
It's interesting because when you read those qualities there, they didn't sound wordy actually, and that last one is quite strong, isn't it? You don't despise people because of their loss. I've been watching quite a number of David Attenborough programs recently, and one of the things that I was noticing from nature documentaries is that, well, obviously one of the things that can happen when an animal is in a position of weakness as part of a collective is it's moved to the outside, or it's even sometimes cast out completely. And just when you read that there, that thing, you don't despise people because of loss, when they're weakened by their circumstances, it actually requires an effort to move towards them rather than default to a certain kind of carelessness about them, or allowing them to drift to the fringes or something. Does that make sense?
Like, absolutely. Yeah, and it's a beautiful image, you know. And, that, you know, using the Buddhas, the stories from the life of the Buddha, you know, about the monk, a case of dysentery. Mm. Or the monk that, you know, when the Buddha found that someone wasn't being taken care of, he actually admonished the monks to take care.
Yeah. Taking care is a very nice way to bring it to an end, isn't it? That whole sense of just everything implied in that statement of taking care, you know, as a practice and as an ideal.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for sharing all this today. Are there ways people can find out particularly about chaplaincy if they're interested in training that you would recommend?
Yeah, well, the one that you mentioned, Angulimala, is specifically for prison chaplaincy, and for healthcare chaplaincy, I can't remember the acronym, Buddhist Healthcare Chaplaincy Support Group, BH, you know,
Work it out. Well, we'll put the links on the post
when
we put
this up,
so there's some links there we can look them up on Google or wherever it is. But thanks very much for taking the time. Really lovely to hear about your work. Very
Thank
inspiring
you.
And well done. Fantastic training.
Thank you very much.
You can hear this via our SoundCloud page or our AudioBoom page. You can find them on the homepage of thebuddhacentre.com if you can't find them through searching. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and we'll be back very soon with more Buddhist voices. But thanks very much for now, and thanks very much to Amitashuri.
Thank you, Chandradasa, and everyone else. Take care.